Good afternoon, everyone. This is Cheryl Castile, and welcome to The Exchange. My two guests I have in the studio today, Jerry McGee and Andrew Hunter, are working on a project together, which includes a focus on the musicians, legendary musicians from this area, fiddle player Dennis McGee, who just happens to be Jerry's father, and accordionist Amadei Ardoin. But Jerry, I am thrilled to have back in the studio. He is an incredibly talented musician. Actor, plays a bit of accordion, plays a heck of a mean guitar.
My goodness.
Yeah.
I'm humbled.
There you go. Has played with so many people throughout the years, mm-hmm. Kris Kristofferson, Delaney and Bonnie. I always like to throw in the Monkees because that's that's my generation.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
As a kid. And the Ventures, still with the Ventures.
Yeah, I still work with them in the summertime. We go to Japan every summer, but other than that, I just do projects on the side, recordings and stuff.
So it's great to have you back.
It's great to be back back in Lafayette and trying to establish some musical challenges here.
We lost you to California for quite a few years, but we're glad you're back in the area.
I'm glad to be back.
Yeah. It is, And Andrew Hunter, who is a actor, film, and theater from the area here, also an educator with Lafayette Parish School System. And I'm always thrilled for whoever the students are that get you. And if you haven't seen Andrew in any theater productions, you really need to. Recently was seen in Shotgun, which also was part of a trilogy with Rising Water that was based on following Hurricane Katrina. During Hurricane Katrina and following is what that trilogy focused on.
Yes.
And then one of my favorites, Jaron Shake Snyder's original piece, We All Do, in which one of the characters you played was a trash can.
Yes.
And I have to say, mesmerized the entire audience.
Thank
which
you for that.
We'll talk a little bit later about that. But it was, I can't tell you how often I think about that role. So welcome,
Jaron is great, and I thank her for it. Thank you, Cheryl.
Yeah. I think we're going to stick with you just for a minute. You know, for people who aren't familiar with you, Andrew, where did you grow up?
Abbeville, Louisiana.
You grew up in Abbeville.
Yes.
That's a beautiful community.
It is.
Yeah.
I'm glad to call it home.
Yeah. And when did theater enter into your life? Or acting? And maybe it wasn't theater first.
Studying here at the university, my first 3 years were focused in music. And
really?
Yeah. When that didn't work out, I walked over into this building, Burke Hall. And they opened their arms to me, and I never looked back.
Well, wait. Well, okay, back up. I didn't know about the music part of you.
I studied music ed for 3 years before coming over and
what
hitting
were you
stage.
Playing?
Baritone.
Baritone.
Of all instruments. Yeah.
Really?
I played horns.
How young were you when you started playing music?
Oh, like the fourth, fifth grade. You know, getting into the music in middle school and then continuing on through high school, drum major and all that nonsense.
You were the drum major?
Yeah, it was serious
for a
while.
But you know what's interesting about that? That's a really theatrical part to be in when you're the drum major.
I made the decision in high school to kind of focus on the music more than the poetry and the speech and debate and all those things. And by the time I got to college, thought that, you know, being a band director and having my own band, all that good stuff, you know, it spoke to me. But it was a different challenge.
Yeah. I'm curious, what made you head over to the theater department?
I'm going to be really nice and say that it was just being able to use this instrument, you know, which is my body and my voice, was a lot easier than using another instrument.
Huh.
I'll give shout-outs to some coworkers. Chad Viatar and Joseph Butts were studying music the same time I was there. They're
very
incredible
musicians.
We'd be in the practice room still 4-5 in the morning sometimes, and they always seemed to be enjoying it. And I was always like, when can I go home? But it wasn't like that whenever I found the stage. It was much more smooth.
Do you still pick up an instrument at all?
I picked up the trumpet briefly in the last performance that I had, In His Grace, which was a...
That's right. You were in His Grace, too. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no. I just had to...
I missed this one.
I say now that I don't pick up instruments. My characters pick up instruments.
Yeah.
But it's moments like hooking up with Jerry and being able to focus on this piece, which has a musical center, that it brings me right back to home.
Yeah, that ties the two together for you.
Absolutely.
So you went to school here then in through the theater department?
03.
Okay. That's when you graduated, was 03?
Yeah.
And then where did you go from there?
I've been
here. With acting.
I started teaching immediately upon graduating and then stepped off of the stage for about 3 years.
Yeah, that's
really.
Yeah.
Because I think I met you when you got back on the stage.
Yep.
I met you.
I had a brief
you.
Moment getting back on, you know, following graduation. Really getting off was like raising the family and being fulfilled in teaching.
Yeah.
But it always calls me back.
Yeah. What that time, though, that you took off, mm-hmm. Were there some benefits that you saw in terms of when you got back into acting that 3-year period gave you?
Absolutely. I've taken 2 3-year periods off. So if it was anything to say about how nice the first one was, mm-hmm. the second one, I think more than anything, whenever you take time away, you realize, first of all, how deep the passion is, because you're not fulfilled really in anything else in life unless you're doing it. But you need those moments to kind of reflect, go back inside for a bit, not have all the characters in your head or have the rat race, which is the rehearsal process and then doing the productions. It's kind of an addiction of mine, and I try to keep those addictions in check. So I try
it
not
to. It means good you realize that.
Well, absolutely. Like whenever I'm doing shows, as many as I can take, and sometimes you take too many. But I finally, after a couple years off here and there, found the balance.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be all in or all out.
You know, I'm curious about this, Andrew, because I've wanted to ask you this since I watched you play that trash can. we all do. For people that aren't familiar with that production, it really focused – it brought to life inanimate objects.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of common everyday things that wind, which isn't an inanimate object, but things that are just around us in life. It gave those – character.
Mm-hmm.
It gave them a voice. It gave them movement. And so when I watched, when you played that trash can,
mm-hmm.
I would assume, not being involved, you know, as an actor or anything, that is there a different process preparing for bringing a role like that to life versus playing an actual human character?
Every process is unique, you know, in its own way. And in this one, Jaron Schechtsnyder gave me a tremendous character to take hold of. Elsa Dimitriadis was fantastic
as
a director. Wanderlust as a theater company takes on those projects that are a little out there as far as where they can take the audience. And it was an interesting voyage. I had no idea that people would be so attracted to that character. I was just kind of trying to do my job, but it became something much, much bigger than myself.
I'm assuming you had other people make comments to you about that, Because I had a lot of people make comments to me about you.
Before one of those breaks, at one point way back when I played Macbeth with Acting Up here in Lafayette, and then after you play a role like that, you might get recognized here and there as, oh, you were the guy that played Macbeth. Mm-hmm. After We All Do, that completely disappeared, and I was I walked down Jefferson and somebody would just – you were the trash can.
The trash can.
Oh my God, that's the trash can. Or somebody comes to see a show and, you know, afterwards, we appreciate the work you did.
Yeah.
God, that trash can was so. And it wasn't me. The entire cast of We All Do. And
well, everybody did. But what was interesting about a show like that is that, and Jaron and I had a conversation. She was on the show and we had a conversation about that. That it's what a lot of the Hollywood movies have done now with a lot of the animated movies, where so many people now look at trees different. People looked at trees different after Lord of the Rings,
Absolutely.
That came out, you know, and you begin to have a different relationship, but because of what you brought to that character. You know, people start having their own conversations with things in the grocery store or with trash cans, you know?
Absolutely. I personally had an experience standing with Stephen Cooper, one of my coworkers, who was also a cast member.
Who will be on next week, by the way.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Shout out. We were standing somewhere and a dumpster was getting emptied, and that sound effect of the beep, beep went off, and I had a serious moment of like, I was scared as the character that I played would have been. So it definitely sticks with you. It's going to be with me for a very, very long time. Probably one of my favorite roles ever. And the fact that people enjoy it and remember it is what we do.
Yeah. Yeah. Very nice. I thank you for talking to that, because it was something to see. It was something very unique.
It's always good to go back to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my experience when I first went to California in 1960, I went with the idea that I wanted to be an actor as well as play music, of course, you know, and the music was my primary goal. But once I got out there, I was playing this little club and approached one night by some people and said, hey, you know, there's an acting class we're taking. Are you interested in going over there? And I said, well, sure. I've always wanted to do that. So I joined this class, and the actor's name that was teaching, his name was Jeff Corey, and he was teaching the method
okay.
from the Actor's Studio.
Yeah.
So my first experience with that deal was I was asked to play a chair. So that's why this story kind of made me chuckle, because that was my experience.
Yeah, because that's part of that process.
That was one of the
classes.
That was the thing I had to do in class, was pretend that you're a chair, an inanimate object. And needless to say, after that, a few weeks of that class, I decided that the method wasn't
that wasn't what you wanted.
And that wasn't what you wanted.
You know, I'm curious what was occurring in your life prior to going out there that you were interested in acting. What grabbed
my
your
career,
interest?
I was broke before that. I was poor. I was living in Shreveport.
Yeah.
I was working in clubs and sleeping on people's couches and cars for about a year. And, and somebody said, hey, you know, if you want, why don't you go to California? Another musician who worked out there and said, why don't you go to California? You know, you might be able to get a job. So,
but in acting or with music, was he focused
well,
on?
I was music. Obviously, I was looking at that factor first.
Yeah.
That was my first, you know, goal.
Yeah.
But the acting, I was wanting to kind of, you know, get into acting somewhere along the road, and it was an opportunity to go to California. So, and somebody said, "Hey, if you don't make it, you can always pick oranges. There's a lot of orange groves out there."
Yeah,
so,
that's a backup plan. Yeah.
So I'm ready for that. So. I hitchhiked and went out to California in 1960, and the rest is history.
And the first film that you were in was what?
The first film that I worked as an extra. I started getting work as an extra because I wanted to be involved in the process. I wanted to learn. I wanted to look and study exactly what the process was. I believe it was a Hank Williams Jr. movie at MGM that they were doing. Remember Hank Williams Jr.?
Sure, yeah,
he was a big country guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he was just starting out, and for some reason they found him some kind of film that, you know, story. So
that he actually was in the film.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was in it. He was acting in it. It was Nanette Fabre was the actress, and his director. I remember his name. His name was Arthur Dreyfuss. He was a German director, and I had a scene where I had to play the harmonica on the microphone. And as I was playing, he kept stopping. He'd say, "Cut, cut! You must get closer to the microphone." You know, so it's like I'm freaking out. I'm getting closer and closer. And he stopped about. He cut the scene about three times, and I was ready to like scream. And I was so embarrassed. I'm sure everybody was like, "What's wrong with this guy? He can't get it right." You know.
Yeah.
But I eventually did it, and that was the first, my first, pretty much introduction to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Was that thing there.
What came after that then?
Let's see. A little later, I did a Bobby Darin recording session, and then eventually I moved out to Las Vegas and worked in Las Vegas. The movie thing came kind of later in the 60s, really, in the 70s when I really started working with Kris Kristofferson, started doing his movie, Stars Born, Convoy, Heaven's Gate, and I did all that stuff. And I did a lot of TV shows, Simon and Simon, Night Court. I did a lot of that.
Oh, I didn't know the TV part of that.
Yeah, I did. Ah. I did tons of as an extra. L.A. Law. I did tons of stuff where I got upgraded in some scenes. You know, I had silent bits. You know, they give these little bits. So I did that for several years and got into as much as I could. Like I say, I wanted to learn filmmaking and get in as an actor. I got a SAG card and went out for interviews, and didn't quite make it. I didn't have the time. My music took pretty much most of my work. And,
which isn't a bad reason of why.
Exactly. And I had to make money. So, I mean, you know, the acting thing, I said, somewhere down the road I'll pursue it or do it at some point in my life somewhere. So that's pretty much how it happened. And I did, in fact, I did a miniseries called North and South that Olivia de Havilland was in. And I had a big scene with her in Kirstie Alley where I'm just a Confederate guy who's bleeding and my leg's bleeding and she puts a tourniquet on it.
Yeah.
And I reach out at some point and I'm untied and I bleed to death. So Kirstie Alley or Olivia de Havilland blames Kirstie Alley for letting me bleed to death, and it got into this big deal. But anyway.
Did you die in the picture?
I did.
Did you
I
have bled, to do that on scene?
I bled to death. That was it. Just me laying on this cot, they're fighting over my leg. My wife, we got videotaped it on right?
Well, yeah, so many of those you can put. And we do have Dee Dee here in the studio today, and she said she's going to be silent, but we may pull her in on some stuff.
But anyway, we videotaped it because I hadn't seen it in years, and we saw it one night. It was on television, and I had to watch it and finally got to see the scene I was in. So,
well, I will confess, I had to, after I had you on the first time, I went back, and you know, you can pull up a lot of movies now, and of course I pulled up A Star Is Born. It's like, there's the scene.
Yeah, and I had some dialogue in that scene, but of course they cut it out. But somebody sent it to me, and I did find it. I had one line or something in the film, but that was my big claim to, being in a big movie, Barbra Streisand. Wow.
But now that's where that's where more of the money comes in film, if you get a speaking, even if it's one line, right?
Yeah, you get paid.
The money gets.
Yeah, if you have no dialogue, you get paid $500. If you do a silent bit, in other words, if you're in a scene like we're sitting in here with the lawyers and I'm sitting here and I got to react to whatever's going on, you get $500 for the day. You have no dialogue, nothing to say.
Yeah.
But you get paid. It's called a silent bit. That's what they call it. So you get paid like $500. And I had a few of those. I got lucky. They would call me from the side and I'd get in a scene. And the Streisand thing, she called me. I was standing off the side. And the one scene where I slapped her on the
rear.
Behind her in that one scene. And it was her idea to do it. So it was a nice shot.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. More ways than one, a nice
shot.
Yeah,
I got paid for it.
Love it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry,
I love
what?
That.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah.
Well, lately with music, where has your, what direction
well,
has
music,
your life gone?
Well, this film project is kind of taking a precedent over the music. I can always play music. It's not something I can't do.
Yeah.
But I've had this on my mind for years. It's kind of a passion I've had to do this story about my dad and Amadeus. So I decided to try to get it, get it going and start working on it and writing it. So I've been writing that and looking for
it. Had you written anything like this before?
Never did, huh? This is the first time I've ever written. I'm directing. I'm pretty much producing. I'm one of the main actors. I'm playing my dad, which is a little bit strange. Of course, he was during the 30s. He was a little bit younger than I am today. But
sure.
It's not about the age factor. It's more about the relationship between Amadeus and my father, how they met in a cotton field picking cotton. And they had something in common, which was music, and brought them together.
Yeah. Now, do you remember, I'm trying to think now, when Amadeus died, you were...
He died in 1941, I believe, in Pineville. Yeah. He was committed to a mental institution.
Yeah, so you were pretty...
Yeah, I was about 3 years old.
Yeah, you were young.
Yeah, something like that. But he did, apparently, my sister, who's my oldest sister, said he did visit. He came to see us one time. We lived in Eunice in the 40s, the early 40s or late 30s or something. He'd come to see Daddy or something at one point. But I want to show that the passion they both had for what they were doing, and they kind of – that's all they want to do is play music.
And do you remember as a young, even 8, 9, 10 years old, do you remember your – dad talking about him?
Yeah,
you remember
absolutely.
The stories from?
I didn't really get the full recognition of it till I became an adult pretty much, but I did hear talk through the years. I mean, I played with my father when I was a teenager. I started playing guitar, and he would mention Amadeus. He said, me and Amadeus did this song, and we went here to play. We went to New Orleans, and people were crazy about us. They wanted us to play everywhere, together. It was that kind of relationship. But I didn't really realize the full extent of the relationship until later and started reading about it and seeing exactly and the tragedy of what happened to Amadeus at that point. So,
refresh my – because I'm not remembering this, but when – did you play with your dad at all when you started playing guitar?
The only professional thing that we played together was Christofferson played in Baton Rouge in 1977, I believe. He had a big concert there, and of course I was playing with him. So he knew about my dad. I told him, and he said, look, I want you to get your dad and your uncle to come to Baton Rouge, and I want him to come up and play a few songs. I mean, he paid.
And your uncle was?
Sadie Corville. Sadie Corville, yeah. He had him come out, and he paid him $700. He had a limo pick him up from the hotel, brought him to the auditorium, and had him come up on the stage. I'm sure that was a highlight of their life.
Oh, yeah.
My father and Sadie Corville.
I mean, that'd be pretty cool for you, too, to have him come
up. It was incredible. The people, it was about, I don't know how many people is it an amphitheater in Baton Rouge, or I don't know what the name of the place is, but it's a big, kind of like Hyman's.
Was that the Rivergate?
Huh?
Rivergate.
I don't remember, but it was a big, huge concert hall.
Do you know Cecil? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
So they played some of your dad's music
when they got up.
And did Kris Kristofferson play with them?
Yeah, well, not really. He just said, hey, I want you all to come out. Yeah, come on out and sing a couple of songs. You know, thing. So they came out and played two or three songs, and people went wild. I get some comments everybody once in a while on Facebook about it. Hey, yeah, I was at that show. I saw your dad and Sadie Corville, you know, so... Yeah, they had a long relationship, my father and Sadie.
Sure,
they played together. And Sadie actually played with
Amadei
and played on some records of his.
Yeah.
At some point, yeah.
So the writing for this, when you actually sat down with pen to paper, how long ago did that start for you?
I'd say a few weeks ago, probably.
Oh, just that?
A few weeks ago.
Okay.
It's like that stuff comes like music. When you're writing a song, it's like you have all these images and you have all these – lyrics are coming at you and melodies and stuff, and so I'm playing them, and you know, and that's what's happened right now. It's like an inspiration. I'm getting these words and I'm getting the situation.
Yeah.
So it's like it's automatic. I'm not even struggling. I can just be sitting down watching television. All of a sudden, I hear the lines are there, and I just write them out in the character. So, you know, it's going to be great.
You know what I want to do for people? Cecil, we are going to switch around here in the order. For people that are listening that aren't familiar with Amadei Ardoin and with your dad, with Dennis McGee, let's play a tune. We're going to do the Amadei Two-Step, which features your dad on fiddle and Amadei Ardoin on accordion. And that'll give folks an idea of what we're talking about here musically.
Yeah.
Para, tá do nada, tá do sim.
That was Amédée Ardoin and Dennis McGee with Amédée Two-Step. If you just join us, this is The Exchange on KRVS 88.7 FM or on the web at krvs.org. We are a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, and want to say hello to all the folks in Lake Charles listening also. If you're just joining us, my guest today in the studio is Jerry McGee and also Andrew Hunter. And we are going to – we mentioned it earlier, but we're going to pull Dee Dee McGee in on this part of the show. And we're going to talk a little bit more about a project that has been in your heart for a long time, for Jerry, focusing on his father, the relationship between Dennis McGee and Amédée Ardoin. So you talked about you just started writing this about 3 weeks ago, but the ideas have been there for
like
a
that.
Long
yeah,
time.
Yeah, I've had that idea in my mind for a long time. Not quite sure how I'm going to pull it off because it's a period piece. It's 1930s Depression, so you know there's not a lot of place to be filming 1930s. You know, so you have to create an atmosphere. So I think I can do that.
Yeah.
Most of it's going to be done out in the country where nothing's changed in a lot of years.
That's right.
Out in Chitanya and out in that part of,
outside
of Eunice, it's still pretty much the same as it was back then.
Yeah, you can find areas that
look
like that,
you know. Yeah.
I mean, I always think, too, because I live out in St. Landry Parish, that, there's a lot of places that have been maintained or preserved because a lot of them, they're caught up in just some kind of family will or whatever they haven't decided what's going to happen to it yet, which helps for projects
it
like
does.
This.
It does. Absolutely.
And so you decide to do this. I'm going to pull you in a minute, Dee Dee, but we needed an Amédée.
I looked at a few faces. I got on a computer and checked out because that's what I'm looking for first. I'm looking for a physical face, something.
Yeah.
I couldn't find anybody. I'd looked at about four different people and didn't see anybody. There was one person that played accordion, a local guy played accordion here in town, and he sang Amadeus songs and played accordion, and he would have been pretty close to what I wanted, but he declined. He wasn't interested. I kept looking, and then I talked to Dee Dee, my wife, about that, and she said, well, I'll ask Patsy. What's her name?
Patsy B. Avenue.
Avenue.
Yeah.
Hey, Patsy.
So
anyway, Patsy came up with Andrew, who I looked at his picture and I said, yeah. And both Dee Dee and I saw it. I said, yeah, I don't even have to audition him, really. I mean, he's got theater experience, and that's a big plus.
That's right. And people that too, Patsy B. Avenue is a incredible actress and singer.
Absolutely.
She's a lot of people know her from Melting Pot, from being in that group for a long time in this area. Had you known Patsy prior to being in His Grace in that production with her?
No, we worked on In His Grace together, and that was an amazing production and cast. And when I got the message from Jerry about the possibility, I don't know if they shared or if I asked, how did you guys find out about me? And they're like, oh, Patsy. Sure enough, I saw her backstage like one of the nights, towards the end of the run. And I was like, oh, thanks for that, the tip, to Jerry about the possibility to work on this film project. We're going to, have a meeting and talk soon about it. And she was just like, nobody else came to mind. I didn't know even working with her on stage that she thought as highly of me, and vice versa. She's an incredible singer, an incredible actress, and to be held in high esteems and to be, referred, I can't thank her enough.
Were you familiar, Andrew, at all with either of these two musicians, with Dennis or with Amédée?
No, I've kind of fallen into a
different generation.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those things, that for it to be such an amazing story, I was kind of upset at myself for not having heard of it, before. But I mentioned to a few friends that I was maybe going to work on this project, and they were like, OMG.
Yeah, yeah.
Seriously, yeah. So they had heard of him. I was just kind of late on the on the bandwagon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What, just since this all came about, and I'm curious, so you get the name, you get the picture actually first of, yeah. Was there any type of audition process? Or
I didn't even think of that. I knew he had theater experience, and that pretty much was the look, and he had the look, and he had his acting, you know.
Yeah.
It's a little different. Film's a little different, of course, but an actor, if you're an actor, you can act it, you know,
yeah.
Regardless. Even if you wouldn't have been an actor, I think physically, I think Andrew would have been right for it anyway.
Yeah,
you know, the face, you know, the first thing I saw, I looked at Amade, and I thought, yes, man, it's close.
Yeah, it'll work. You know. What have you learned about the person you're going to be portraying up to this point?
Man, the story, you know, of his life is very vague and very sporadic.
And different stories.
And yeah, it's almost folklore in the sense that, you know,
yeah,
Jerry has the
that.
Experience of having had the family connection, you know, with him, and so the closeness there lets him want to tell the story as genuine as possible without any fodder, and just to be really clear about who this guy was. And myself, you know, aside from him being a person who obviously loved his music, to be an open enough person to, you know, practice and play in places that might have been a little dangerous at the time, to take those chances to just practice the art, and to have, as many artists do, this kind of end of life story that is not at all worthy of the life, you know, that he lived and the artist that he was, you know, the decline in the time that he spent, you know, in Pineville. Mm-hmm. There was a reference to Pineville in His Grace, and I didn't really know what the Pineville reference would have been before that production.
Sure,
but to know now that there is this place that you can be sent off to, and people sometimes might forget about you or not recognize that, you know, once your family is lost, once you're in that place and you're all alone, what happens then? Mm-hmm. So it's going to be interesting. I'm still in the process of learning a lot about this character. You know, we're shooting starting this week, and Jerry and I are going to sit even tomorrow and kind of have some of the first rehearsals where we start looking at those scenes that he's written, et cetera. But, I mean, I'm taking everything that he can give me directly, but it's like little snippets of snapshots of his life.
Yeah.
You know, Jerry, there's a lot of people like Andrew out there who were not familiar with your dad or with Amade.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about your father?
A couple of people. One person I inquired about, the accordion player and sang, had a sort of a, I don't know, I want to do that. I can't do that. There was a sort of an ominous feeling that I had, perhaps, that seems to be. And there was another person that I found that had the same kind of deal. It was like, Amade, I don't know, I can't do that. I think there's some sort of voodoo thing connected somehow.
Yeah,
it seemed like I had that feeling because the man died in such a tragic way at that time. And he was loved by everybody in that area around Eunice and Chitanya and Dural and all that area where he played. He was a gypsy, and there is a folklore thing about Amade Ardoin. Nobody knows a lot about him. His family way back then, nobody, you know, he was raised an orphan. I think he and didn't have a family. And I think his father or grandfather was a slave, I think, originally that all came about. So, but the man loved music, and his passion was music, and that's all he wanted to do. He roamed the countryside and walking with his flower sack with his accordion in it, and would play for anybody and anybody that said, hey, you want to play? And they'd hire him. And he and my father played. They went all over. They went to New Orleans and recorded. They took a train and went to New Orleans and recorded.
Which was a really big deal back then.
Yeah. There's a man that discovered him on this cotton, property that they were picking cotton. There's a man that came along and heard him and said, hey, you guys sound great. How about coming to New Orleans and record? I'm not going to be able to go to New Orleans and do that, so I'm going to have a studio here in town where I can show them actually recording.
Sure, sure.
And singing some of those songs and stuff. But there is a mystique connected to Amade and my father, even both of them, because I don't know a lot about what happened in terms of their relationship and their day-to-day relationship. So I have to assume or create some of the events that happened, which is kind of like taking liberty with the story in a sense and making my own story, but keeping the main parts of that story them meeting and them going to New Orleans and the tragedy of Amade playing in his club and going outside and two guys jumped him.
Well, and you know, and you think though back, like you talk about them going to New Orleans. I mean, it was a big deal back then that, you know, one white guy, one black guy, mm-hmm. traveling
yeah,
together, going
the
to
train.
Play, you know.
They took the train and went to New Orleans, yeah. I'm yeah. sure that was, yeah, absolutely, you know. We can't sit here and he's going to sit in another car or something like that.
Exactly.
The segregation obviously was a 1930s depression.
Which would have had, you know, a real unique effect on their relationship. You still see, you know, a lot of the prejudice and things today, in a different way. Mm-hmm. Really had to deal with, I mean, like you talk about that separation, you know, they probably didn't sit in the same, you know, they
no,
didn't sit in the same
car. That's right. Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. But my father just never had anything bad to say about Amade. I mean, he loved music and he loved Amade. And this YouTube, my father's talking about Amade. He was a great guy. Wonderful to be with and play with, and he was a close friend. They were friends, really, those guys, you know, in spite of the separation, they managed to create all that music and play together.
Yeah.
And people did love them. A lot of the people, all the people, you know, folks around it in that at that time, nobody. My father did carry a weapon around with him and a brass knuckle, so you'd tell me that.
Yeah.
Just in case, you know, just to protect, you know, because there was some, you know, sometimes yahoos.
That's right.
Like these two guys that came from North Louisiana into this club, and I'm going to show that where they're sitting out there watching Amade play, and they're drunk and they're making comments and rude comments about him, you know, what's this guy doing here, blah, blah, blah. And Amade finishes playing, and he goes out the door, and those guys follow him out the door, and then we fade to black. So I'm not going to show any of the violence. I mean, I thought about maybe trying to choreograph it or show it in some point, maybe in darkness or something like that, but I don't need to do that. It's going to be implied, and you're going to know what happened to the man because it's going to be at the end, it's going to be a whole narration of it, eventually what happened to Amade Ardoin at the end, you know.
Well, you know, when you look at, too, that, I mean, these are two individuals who their music – was so important.
Absolutely.
You know, not only to this area, but beyond now to, you know, so many different areas throughout the world that where the people focus on different types of traditional folk musics, you know?
Well, the music that came, the Zydeco came after
right.
You know, and all that. And, of course, Cajun music. I always like to call it Louisiana French music.
Exactly.
That's what I like it because that's what it was originally called back then.
That's right.
Somebody tagged on Cajun music, which is okay. It works too, but I prefer Louisiana French music.
Yeah. As things have gone on in life, everybody has to kind of get their little categories
Exactly. Yeah. You know, people have to change, you know, their own to suit themselves in a sense.
You know, I had a record store for a long time in Opelousas, and a lot of the older players used to come in and had that conversation so many times of what you just talked about.
Really?
That's just how they would rather refer to it. You know, that back then nobody put them into the different categories. Yeah. And so many people, too, especially those that were sharecropping together, you know, they played the same stuff.
Yeah.
You know, they learned from each other. They may have had some different influences, but they played the same thing.
I think the Louisiana French music, probably some people look at that connotation as it doesn't belong to the whole state.
That's right.
It's a personal music. It belongs to Cajun people and people who live down in this part of the country.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what they wanted to make it their own by calling it Cajun music.
Yeah.
So I think that's what happened. But overall, I just think it's pretty much Louisiana French music.
That's right. Well, let's listen. I would like to play a track of your dad's.
Okay.
I think of so many, especially out of this area, so many fiddle players. His music is taught every day around here.
Yeah, sure.
And played every day. And we're going to listen to this is his dad, Dennis McGee, but we're going to listen to Adieu Rosa. Mm-hmm. This is one of my favorite ones.
Adieu Rosa.
Yeah. If we can put that one on, CISO, that's off then. Thank you. ¶¶ right. That was Dennis McGee. We're talking about all kinds of music here. But that was actually Jerry's father, Dennis McGee, on fiddle. And like I said, a real that man, his music, so many folks in this area, that's what they teach. That's what they learn, that, mm-hmm. you know.
Sure. Yeah.
What he played.
Yeah. This film is going to – it's not – you know, my father was a solo artist in his own right, obviously. He
hadn't
made records, but I couldn't – I couldn't do both, you know. I had to split it up and make it two people, about two people playing together, and that's pretty much what they were doing at that time, playing together and, you know, creating their own music. It was Amadé's music mostly, but my father was there to support him, and he was, you know, so they had that relationship. I wish I could have just done a whole story about my father and a whole story about Amadé, but it's just, you know. There's no way I could do that.
Yeah, and but it's such a great, unique story with the two of them.
It
too,
is,
you
absolutely,
know?
Yeah, yeah.
So have you picked up an accordion yet, or had you ever prior to this?
The interesting thing is that I've always wanted to, and Jerry's going to put one in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that he has like the best like or newest instrument, you know, whenever I'm going to have it as a character. But no, I've never touched it. And I've always wanted to.
Sure, yeah,
so,
yeah.
Ironically enough, this is going to be.
Yeah, it'll be foreign to you.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But you'll get. I'll just show you. It's not a big deal. Just kind of fake it.
Yeah, you heard that. It's not going to be a big deal.
Yeah.
Of course, Andrew has some old French as well, Cajun French. So pretty much all of it has to be in French. So some of the songs that he's going to be singing is going to be in French. But I think what I'm going to do is I'm not going to play the whole song. It's just going to be we're going to cut during the song, go to something else. You know.
What about the dialogues between the conversation between the two characters?
They didn't speak English.
Yeah, so are you going to – is that all going to be in French too?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to do it. Yeah, and I'm going to mentor Cajun French.
You still speak French?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Je parle beaucoup bien.
Very nice.
Moi, je parle français.
So you've got a lot of work ahead of you.
Absolutely. The wonderful thing about this challenge is it's the first film project that I'm going to work on. You know, the theater is my home.
Yeah.
But in making the transition even into this summer, I was already
thinking you had done a couple, like, bip things in film.
A commercial or
that's
something.
That's what it was. Okay.
Nothing that I consider at this point anything this serious.
Yeah.
As you can already tell, you know, by some of the challenges that are ahead of me. But I was really craving that. And to have the universe line it all up, I didn't have to search for it. It was just kind of, here's the time. I love telling stories, and this is one where as soon as I heard it, I was just like, wow, I'm about to possibly be part of telling a story that people are really going to love.
Yeah.
Jerry obviously really loves it. It's close to his heart. Yeah. As soon as I heard it, I fell in love with it, and I think, you know, it's a story that needs to be told you know, for the area.
Growing up in this area, and was there anybody in your family around who spoke French at all?
Oh, no.
Really?
Abbeville, I thought everybody spoke French.
No, well, my grandmother's family is like originally Mobile. My dad's side is like Tulsa, Vegas, Cali.
Okay.
Like, yeah, none of us are Cajun in whatever sense of roots. I have family in New Orleans, but even there, it's kind of a melting pot. You know, so to be here, I had friends that all had grandmas, you know, that spoke it, and I was just like, what'd she say? Don't worry about it. Come on. It's going to be an interesting challenge.
You know, and for you playing a character that really experienced some prejudice back then, and it wasn't only black people. I mean, there were a lot of Cajun folks in there too, especially if you were a sharecropper, you experienced a lot of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming in your life at some time there has been some things that you may have experienced, right?
Correct.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't want to assume, but
no, for sure.
Yeah, where you can go in with some real life. I mean, you know what that's all about.
Yeah, it's always a tough thing to look at reenacting that. But even as I got on the stage and from Dr. Alex Marshall, for instance, who as a mentor
I
love Doc as well. Yeah. Shout out, Doc.
Yeah.
He would explain to me, even as he was teaching me here at the university, that there were times that he wasn't able to get on stage or even able to practice his craft because of whatever race issues might have come up.
That's right.
You know, the difficulty as artists that we have is not dealing with all of that, you know, as creators. But at the same time, the reality of this story is that it's what impacted many crucial moments in his life.
Yeah.
And for me, it's just great to tell the story, you know, to look back. And Jerry mentioned earlier the idea of maybe voodoo being involved, or the idea of race, you know, and that being a really difficult issue to take on. The more challenges, the better.
Yeah. You know, you see that there were so many things in life that where different prejudice has existed. People involved with the arts, although prejudice has been there and still is there, there's a lot of artists who didn't allow that to get in the way. That those barriers were broken, you know, through and a lot of times through musicians also, you know.
Well, let's coming back to my father, that certainly was not on his mind. It was had no idea. Didn't even think about race.
Yeah.
All he knew is this man is a great accordion player, and he sings great and writes songs, and I want to play with him.
Do you know how they met?
They met picking cotton, as a matter of fact, picking cotton, working on a farm. My father told me the story, but I'm going to piece things together and kind of recreate what
sure.
I think
yeah,
happened,
yeah.
How they met together and started talking. And then during the lunch break, one or the other had an instrument, whether his mom and dad had his accordion and my father had a fiddle, and they both, at one time or another, they both had the instruments and they were playing.
Yeah.
And that's how they got discovered by this guy who came there and heard them and said, you guys sound great together and you got to come to New Orleans. So I'm going to try to show that a little bit, their meeting and having a conversation. And Amadeus is going to ask Dennis, how long you been playing, blah, 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 you know. And Dennis is going to say, I've been playing since I was 16. I learned when I was 16. En français, je dis ça en français.
Yeah.
Je dis tout ça en français. So it's going to relate that story, my father, when, how he learned to play, and then it'd be a little bit of casual conversation, not a whole lot of dialogue. I don't want to have a lot. I want to show it's going to be a musical thing, but minimal dialogue.
Yeah.
I will have a scene with Andrew at one point. I don't know about anything about Amadeus' romances, whether I'm sure he had at some point romances, but
sure.
I'm going to have a scene with Andrew walking down the road, and this lady's sitting on the porch, and she waves at him like, because he walks by there a lot, and she waves at him. So at one point, she calls him over, and he comes over, and then she says, I see you walking around here all the time. What do you do? You know, and he says, well, I'm a musician. I love music, and I play for many people. So that's sort of a little bit of the dialogue that might be considered. But I want to have that to show that there was a sort of connection where he didn't have that kind of thing, you know, just to kind of beef it up and make it a story, a little bit of story.
It'll be fun for who will be involved with you in terms of costuming.
Because
that's a whole nother.
It's pretty much everybody does their own thing kind of thing.
Because
there won't be any wardrobe on this movie.
Sure.
You know, it's going to be very.
But there'll be friends who will have an eye that, I mean, I know especially with Andrew, too, in theater, there are people that have got an eye.
I mentioned to Jerry, I mentioned Elsa earlier, but Brady McKellar, who works here at the university, is a costumer who, if you're listening, Brady, I'm going to be calling you.
We need some 1930s.
There's just a few items that we need left. We've already made some trips together to kind of look out some things.
We bought a few things. We got the clothes pretty much.
Okay. Yeah, because some great old pictures, too, of all that time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I combed through a lot of that stuff, looking at the styles and what people wore during that time. People wore overalls.
Yeah.
The man who worked and they had fedoras, or they had those little caps. What do you call them?
Newspaper boy caps.
And
wearing
one of those at some point, you know. So that's what they wore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and different with your father than Amadeus. Your father lived to be an old man.
He did.
He
did. 96 years old.
Year did he die, Jerry?
1989.
Okay.
And he was still playing that fiddle, you know, within like a week or 2 weeks. I think that's what kept my father alive all those years and gave him that longevity, was he woke up every day and he had that to look forward to, was that instrument.
Yeah.
First thing he would do every morning. I kind of do that with the guitar pretty much. You know, I kind of get up and I plunk around a little bit every day, you know, just, you know, play something or whatever.
Yeah. Do you use a camera at all? Have you ever gotten behind the camera in a film project?
I never have, no.
Okay.
I never have. You know, I've always wanted to do that. I wanted to be I think in the way back in my mind, I probably wanted at some point to be a filmmaker, and I think this kind of the opportunity came up as this, and I thought, well, hey, you know, why not try it? Why not do it? See if you can do it. And I know I can do it because I've worked on so many movie sets and television. Yeah. I watched, like I said, I studied the process. I watched the camera. I watched the grips. I watched the light man work and all those people putting it together. And then the scripts and all that. So I did a lot of training, and I did take classes as an actor. So I'm a little bit a little knowledge about it.
Yeah. Do you have a schedule at all of when you would really like to start the filming process?
We're going to start Saturday, as a matter of fact.
Oh, well, okay. Yes.
Yeah, it's gonna take a little time to do it because I have to go up to Japan in July.
Yeah, and you stay
July.
For a while when you go there, huh?
A couple of months. Yeah, I'll be back in September, and then we're going to do the dance hall thing when I get back, and try to do the cotton field thing. Shortly, depending on whether I get the funds from Kickstarter or one of those things. I got to get
There's still some cool old, some of the dance halls around that.
Well, this place I'm going to use is in Eunice. It's called the Lakeview.
Are you doing Lakeview?
You know,
that's
Lakeview?
A great spot.
It's got that big old barn out there. It's all made out of wood, and the inside is all wood.
That's
2x4s
and slats. Toby Rodriguez built that. Wow.
Yeah, it looks so authentic. It's just incredible. You know.
Very.
So
cool.
We're going to do the dance hall thing where Amadei and Dennis play one time, and then Amadei plays by
himself.
And great
that it's in the Eunice area.
It's perfect. Yeah. We're going to do it on a Sunday in September. It'll be kind of cool. It'll be nice. The weather will be nice. It's a little hot. We're going to have a hot day out there Saturday.
Yeah.
This is where Amadei and my father meet. My father did meet him in Eunice at one point. He's on railroad tracks because I can't film in the city because it's not 1930s.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do it way out in the country where there's nothing. You see a couple of houses maybe, and it's all sparse. It's only rice fields and just, agriculture.
Sure.
So that's where they meet. And Amadei had been beaten up 2 months before that, and my father hadn't seen him. And all of a sudden, Amadei shows up, and he's walking. And my father sees him, and he's not sure it is him, but he sees him in the distance, and he walks closer. And my father calls at him, Amadei, is that you? I mean, what's wrong with you? Are you sick? Are you drunk? What's wrong with you? And my father said that was an exact experience that he had. He saw Amadei, and he was kind of wobbly, and he was stumbling around. He didn't talk to him. He waved at him and said something, but he never answered him. Amadei never answered him. But I'm going to stretch it, and I'm going to have a little dialogue there that'll kind of create a little bit of, like I said, I got to take liberties to make it interesting. Add some a little bit of drama. In a sense.
So you have a camera person. You have a filmer already.
I have a guy. Yeah, some crew guys from New Orleans are coming in.
The camera guy's
a very experienced guy. He worked on a lot of movies and cinematographer. It's going to be
very nice. Mm-hmm. Well, you two have your work cut out for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm ready. I'm excited.
I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on today to hear about that project.
It's been great to be here.
Yeah. It's going to be something that a lot of people are really going to be looking forward to.
Yeah, hopefully. It'll be a while before we get it done.
That's right.
But hopefully we'll get it done somewhere
down the
road.
Those projects already. Do you have other things that you have coming up, Andrew?
I've taken off for the summer, and that was the awesome thing about Jerry putting this. I mean, I have enough with this project right now between getting some of the language and just kind of enjoying this film experience being the first, like I said. Yeah. So just this.
Yeah. Looking forward to working with Andrew. I think he's got a great job.
Good deal. Mm-hmm. Well, Jerry McGee, Andrew Hunter, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing the end project. And Dee Dee, thanks for jumping in there. We're going to go out. Actually, Cecil, let's give people a taste of Jerry, huh? Let's do that. We're going to listen to this is a piece of Jerry McGee, Sweet Dreams. Have a good week, everyone.